I'm Christopher Leiden, and this is Open Source with Roger Cohen of the New York Times. Quick note first, we're into the last 2 days of our Kickstarter campaign to stretch our podcasts every way. Please go to kickstarter.com, search for Open Source, and do what you can on the deadline. Here's our kind of conversation with the Times columnist who writes from all the ominous places: Tehran, Cairo, Gaza, Jerusalem, the breadth of Europe. Roger Cohen has written a memoir of his Lithuanian, Jewish, South African, English mother's crushing depression. Two great human themes emerge: the damage of displacement, the longing for home, right up there with love and the fundamental instincts. And at the same time, Roger Cohen's own need to escape, to meet the other as equally compelling. By the end of our conversation, Israel is the point of convergence, home at the expense of the other. At my home in Boston, Roger Cohen is unfolding his own family secrets and sharing the uneasy identity of a cosmopolitan, liberal, American Jew who remains a considered and critical Zionist.
In a way, the most dangerous state for me seemed to be stillness and looking inward. And it occurred to me that I myself, although we never talked about it, my family had been much displaced. You mentioned Westminster School. I had a superb private education in Britain. I was fortunate to have that. But I would sit in Westminster Abbey most mornings for 10 or 15 perfunctory minutes and had no idea that my grandmother came from the Lithuanian shtetl. I knew that she spoke Russian to her parrot, and the parrot replied in Russian, but I didn't really know what this signified. And I started thinking about where I was from. I think at some fundamental level, we want to know where we are from. How did we reach this point? And I really didn't know. So there was a broader story there of repetitive displacement over many generations, from Lithuania to South Africa, where my parents were born, my mother being born on Human Street in a little mining town called Krugersdorp, hence the title, then being lifted out of there and plonked down in post-war London with its cold and wind and rain and rationing and post-imperial decline and the difficulty of that adjustment. And then on again, my becoming a U.S. citizen 10 years ago now, and part of the family who was Zionist going to Israel. So I thought I could maybe tell a broad story, but also a very intimate one of my mother's breakdown, which I didn't really know about. I didn't know what had happened to my mother. And when I found in my parents' farmhouse in Wales, about a decade ago, a box which contained her two suicide notes from 1978 and 1982. On both occasions, she survived miraculously. And my father, a physician's very precise annotations on the annus horribilis of 1978 and the other horrendous years that followed, it occurred to me that my mother, who was manic depressive for the last 25 years of her life, that she'd also broken down in my infancy and had what was then called post-puerperal psychosis, now postpartum depression. I didn't know where she'd gone, what had happened to her. And I thought the stories were linked. Maybe the breakdown was linked to the difficulty of leaving something behind, of loss, of forgetting, of beginning again. In the United States, we think of immigration as opportunity, new hope, essentially, but moving on is also loss.
What was the evidence on that incredibly ambiguous, ambivalent story of suicidal depression?
Yeah, I can't prove it scientifically. What I do know is that my mother broke down after she was plucked out of a very tight-knit Jewish community, and in her case, a prosperous one. Her grandfather had arrived penniless. Isaac Michael was his name. I found his...
In Johannesburg?
Yes, he'd moved from Lithuania, arrived aged 18 in Johannesburg. In my research, I found the documentation of his crossing on the Union Castle from London to South Africa. He'd gone from Lithuania to London, and he described his profession as prospector. He was a man of wide ambitions. And Jews having suffered the pogroms in Lithuania, in the Pale of Settlement, found themselves on the right side of the colour line in South Africa, a country then coming into being, the Diamond Rush, the Gold Rush. And he started out as an itinerant salesman and eventually was the co-founder of the OK Bazaars, which was the Macy's of South Africa. So my mother grew up in this cocoon of newfound prosperity. His mansion in Johannesburg became known as Chateau Michael. He had a gardener who he brought out from England. So he was a Jewish pogrom survivor from the shtetl, who was reinvention with every generation, who was suddenly the lord of a small manor in Johannesburg with an English gardener taking care of the estate. And my mother came out of this world into post-war England and cracked up. Would she have been fine if she'd remained in South Africa? I can't prove it. I know that the strain was immense, that she disappeared into psychiatric hospitals after the birth of my sister. And after that was like a tree hollowed out by lightning. She was frail. She tried to express love. She felt great love for both of us, but I think it was always hard for her. And in the last two decades of her life, she always craved return to South Africa. She went back at every opportunity. I can't demonstrate scientifically that her life would have been completely different had she not suffered this trauma of upheaval, but that is my conviction. And, you know, there's a whole new field of epigenetics, it's called, looking mainly at Holocaust survivors and how trauma impacts genetic makeup and is passed down through the generations. I know from having married into a family where my wife's grandmother had been killed in the camps, the trauma doesn't end there. It continues down. In my mother's case and my family's case, the traumas were different ones, but they still involved this repetitive displacement. Beginning again is hard, and belonging, I think, Chris, is a very fundamental human instinct. This desire for home, for belonging, it's right up there with love and other fundamental human instincts. And there was always the anguish in my family, I think, at every stage of this odyssey of, do I belong? If I could just quickly add, I found one of the fascinating things I found on this journey was that my great-grandfather's brother had been a very distinguished rabbi. He was the rabbi to Jewish soldiers in the British Army during World War I. He went round the battlefields of Europe, Passchendaele, Flanders, France, giving last rites to Jewish soldiers who had died in the war. And in 1918, I found his diary in the library of Southampton University, and he writes, "Have we, the House of Israel, at last demonstrated that we belong in Britain? Through this ultimate sacrifice, have we laid to rest every last doubt that we Jews belong in Britain?" And there you see it. Are we completely part of the story? Are we completely part of this society? And of course, 20 years before that, as a foreign correspondent covering the Dreyfus case in France, Herzl had been driven, I think, by the same doubts, to the reluctant conclusion that no, the Jews would never quite belong, and so they needed a homeland.
The notes between your parents are so tender, so loving, so regretful. And on your mother's part, that she wasn't happier. What was the expression of her downside?
Yeah, her love for my father and his... When she died, finally, she died of cancer, finally, 15 years ago. And cancer for her was a derisory thing compared to mental illness. She was immensely stoical in death. And my father broke down completely when she died and said it was like falling in love again. And she had this fixed point in her life of her love for my father. It was a very powerful thing indeed. I think it prevails through all the sadness and difficulty that I describe in the book. I think there is this message of love and hope. But mental illness is a charnel house. It's a very destructive thing. And in any family, my parents' love was sorely tried, sorely tried. And in the last years of my mother's life, my father had a second life. He was He had another relationship with the woman he ultimately married. But I think in his human frailty, as he put it in one letter to me, he tried his best in the agonizing circumstances of living with a woman who was, in answer to your question, two different things. When you're depressed, when you're manic depressive and you're in the depressive phase, you are inert. I think of my mother and I think of this woman under a cloud, not just the dirty bathwater skies of Britain, but an invisible cloud that made it very hard for her to come to the surface. And then she would snap out of it and be this agitated, sometimes angry, busy figure. And very rarely, the June, who she was in her youth and was in moments afterward, a very witty, funny, erudite, vivacious, loving woman who was robbed by this scourge of the possibility of living her life in that contented and balanced condition. So I had to tell her story because I felt there was so much I didn't know and hadn't resolved about her life. And we all have different ways of dealing with the knots inside us, the emotional knots. And mine, I guess, is to write things out because words are my thing.
Others and what of the genetic trickle-down in yourself? What of that did you find in your own self-examination?
Well, I'm not manic depressive. I certainly found it immensely difficult dealing with the loss of my mother over 2 years when I was an infant, which I didn't realize mentally, but it impacted me psychically. And there's been a long journey for me toward acceptance, toward, you know, accepting that this had happened to me, that at times it had made me behave in destructive ways in the relationships I was in. There were moments, I think, when subconsciously I was trying to punish because of the suffering I had had in my relationship with my mom. These are hard things to talk about, hard things to come to terms with. And also, I learned very young to escape, Chris. I learned, and maybe part of that was becoming a journalist, escaping always, moving on, being the outsider, sometimes a little bit the voyeur, looking at other people's stories. And, you know, I built myself a kind of a double life. I describe in the book my repetitive infatuations with the au pairs who were looking after me between the ages. My mother couldn't, she loved me deeply. She couldn't give me, after all this electricity through her brain and the insulin shock treatment she'd been through, she couldn't give me the love that I craved. And so I found ways to deal with that, and there was a kind of repetitive enactment in my life, and it took me a long time to understand it. I was kind of a golden boy, you know. I did very well in school. I was good in England. It matters a lot how good you are at sport. I was good at sport, and I guess it matters in the United States too. But anyway, and then, you know, progressively through my life, I came to see the impact of what had happened and what had been hidden. You know, we need. There were a lot of hidden things in my family.
Meaning?
Well, I didn't know where my mother went when I was two. She disappeared. Now I know because I wrote this book. I managed through Britain's Freedom of Information Act to get fragments of her medical records from 1958 that somehow survived. So I saw the book where at age 29 and written in capital letters, Jew, the only Jew on the page, she was admitted to the Holloway Institution outside London. I read the notes about the debate between my parents over whether she should have electroshock treatment. I know that on August 1, 1958, one day before my third birthday, my mother was strapped down. And Sylvia Plath had electroshock treatment and describes it in the bell jar 2 years before my mother. I think certainly I feel by reading that, I know what happened to my mother. Some people might say, well, why would you want to know that? That's awful. Isn't that just going to... No, I feel much closer to redemption, peace, acceptance through having found out at last what actually happened in my family.
It's fascinating to me partly because my mother's mother suffered a postpartum depression right after she was born. Mm-hmm. She was immediately clapped into a place called the Adams Nervine, two fashionable brand names in the early 20th century. Some of the buildings are still there on Center Street in Jamaica Plain. And she stayed there with a postpartum depression for 7 years. So my mother never saw her except looking out a window for the first 7 years of her life. And to the end of my mother's life, at age 93, she was trying to get me to do what you did, to go and dig up the medical records. What was the diagnosis? Mm. What was the treatment? What did they say?
Do you know what was done to her there?
As far as I know, nothing. Mm-hmm. And it was a condition that would be treated today with a pill or two pills, a week of pills, and you'll be fine. 7 years.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But 7 years, no mom, no mom holding her, and God knows what the trickle-down in my own family is.
You know, in this box in the attic that I described in my at this farmhouse in Wales, my mother hated that house, by the way. It was it was windy, cold, rainy. My dad loved it, loves nature in the raw. Anyway, in the box in the attic, among these annotations of my dad's that I described, he had at one point done a family tree in which he'd put black dots next to the names of every member of the family on both sides who had suffered some form of mental illness. And there were more names with black dots there than not. So, you know, clearly there is an hereditary element. And I feel in my own life, beginning again is tough. And it's too much for some people. It's a project, you know, it's a project of assimilation. It involves leaving, forgetting something, pushing it down, maybe even hiding it. And that's an effort. It's a psychic effort, and it can have a heavy cost.
And yet the objective, and you've gotten a long way down the road, is somehow, it seems to me, to rise above all of those things, to discover the human, to get, as Duke Ellington would say, beyond category, as he surely did, and the great artists do.
Yeah, I mean, the book's called The Girl from Human Street, which, as I said, is the street my mother was born on. And I chose that title in part because I don't think at all that this is a peculiarly Jewish thing that I'm describing. I'm interested in the book, in Israel, in Zionism. I trace my own, the evolution of my own Jewish identity. But I think today, this question of where is home, where do I belong, why do I have this sense of being at the margins of society? You only have to look, Chris, at what's happening in Europe today with the new immigrants of Europe, that's to say the Muslim communities of Europe, to see that this is a much, much broader question. And of course, when my forebears left Lithuania for South Africa, that was it. They left. Somehow word of mouth functioned, even in the late 19th century. And some people, Jews in South Africa, said, hey, this is better than the Pale of Settlement. And so this extraordinary movement began. 90% of South African Jews are of Litvak, Lithuanian descent. Today, those breaks are not as definitive. Take a Pakistani family in Britain. They, in some sense, may live between Lahore and London. They're sending money back. When they can, they go back. But again, the question arises, you know, where is home then? Do I still belong there? Take the Turkish families in Germany or elsewhere in Europe who still send daughters back to the home village to find a husband. It's this life, modern life, is this strange amalgam of identities, which can be a very beautiful thing and a very taxing thing.
Yeah. We'll come to Islamophobia in Europe today, but linger a little moment on this incredibly interesting, subtle, very British anti-Semitism that you grew up with in school. And it wasn't out-and-out destructive, but it never went away either.
Yeah, it didn't go away. As I said, I had this very privileged upbringing. My dad was very successful in Britain. He was appointed a commander of the British Empire, had this wonderful career. And I grew up knowing very little of my Jewish identity. We were Cohens. It wasn't hidden. My dad, before he left South Africa, had been asked by a relative whether he wanted to change his name, given that he couldn't possibly succeed in Britain as a Cohen. And this cousin said, you really must change your name. My dad said, well, I'll go away and think about it. He came back after 4 days and she said to him, so, Sidney, darling, what did you decide? He said, well, I thought about it long and hard and you're right. I'm going to do it. I'm going to change my name. She said, that's wonderful. That's fantastic. To what, darling? And he said, Einstein. So, you know, he wasn't really interested in that. But I at school was, especially my first year in high school, had a lot of effing yid, the Jew boy. Then it kind of eased, went away. That's really when I started thinking about it. I describe in the book how my mother, when we were sitting in a restaurant, I was in my teens, and she was eating her spaghetti. She would always cut her spaghetti, which after my first trips to Italy, I would try to encourage her not to do that. But she that's the way she ate her spaghetti. Anyway, she looked at this family across the room and said, darling, you see that family over there? They're Jewish. Mom, why are you whispering? I'm not whispering, darling, but they are Jewish. And of course, I subsequently discovered Philip Roth, one of his main observations about living in London was that the English, and even English Jews, dropped their voices when they referred to Jews. And I think that is all part of this unwritten compromise that to some extent exists even today in England, which is that as a Jew, and Jews in Britain are very successful, as a Jew, you're discreet. You don't rock the boat. If somebody says, oh, that's so Jewish, you bite your lip, you suck it up, you carry on, you pretend you didn't hear. And I didn't really want to do that after a certain point. There was always a little bit of a feeling of not quite being entirely in the story. It's a hard thing to describe. James Lasdin, who was at Westminster with me and is also a writer, and he had exactly the same feeling when he moved to New York. He said, oh, you can live Jewish identity that way. You can be exuberant about it. You can be open. You can keep your voice at the same level about it. This is also possible. You know, I became an American. I was living in New York for...
Yeah, describe that. What drove you? You had been foreign editor of the New York Times with an English passport.
Yeah. And I just wanted, you know, I'd had a green card a long time. I wanted to make my life in the U.S., so I wanted to vote. So in 2005, I became a citizen. I was told I was the only European to become a citizen under Bush. I don't think that's actually true, but I did that, and I just felt more comfortable overall in the United States. And when I went back to Britain to live, I've been living there I hadn't lived there for 30 years, and the New York Times asked me if I would be based in Europe for a spell. I'm returning to New York in a few months' time, but it will have been 5 years. And I couldn't have written the book, obviously, without going back to think again and look again at what happened. And shortly after I returned, I was at my sister's place, and she had a lodger there. And I then had a BlackBerry, which was what the New York Times was giving us at that time. And I had a playback of a column that I had to look at the end of dinner. And this guy, who I didn't really know, piped up and said, oh, Roger, you've got a Jewberry. And I said, sorry, Craig, what was that? Yeah, Jewberry. So I'm sorry, I really don't know what you're talking about. And he said, well, you know, BlackBerry Messenger, as you know, with BlackBerries, there was this BBM, BlackBerry Messenger, you can send messages between BlackBerries. And I said, well, yeah, what about BBM? What about BlackBerry Messenger? He said, well, it's free. So, and I couldn't believe it. I was speechless, and then I was angry. And anyway, I'm not sure how representative that is of precisely what, but it's there. And in Europe, it is a different story. I noticed even after after the shootings in Paris at the kosher supermarket just a few weeks back, there was a woman interviewed, a French Jewish woman interviewed in the New York Times, and she's talking about her experience. And then she says, but mon mari, my husband, c'est un vrai Français. He's a real Frenchman, you know, meaning that he's not Jewish. And, you know, here's a woman who's been presumably in France for a very long time. And, you know, this little sense of otherness, the anxiety that I described of my great uncle, this not quite belonging. I certainly felt it. Everybody's different. My sister, much less. I mean, she lives in London, but I felt it.
The longing to belong somewhere is one powerful thing, but to my mind, at my age, I don't know why, I'm so impressed with people who don't want to belong. And I'm thinking of Joyce, especially, leaving Ireland, leaving father, leaving church, leaving the empire. going to Trieste to find his own, you know, consciousness and to get out of here and to assert, you know, in that classic early modern sense, the human. And I bring it up partly because in a way, you as a caricature, you flying all over the place looking at everything with a kind of human eye, driving toward that too, right?
Yeah, and this image of Joyce in Trieste, you know, working in this very anonymous day job and writing some of the greatest novels of the 20th century, it's fascinating. And Chris, I was very drawn to otherness, if you like, to observerdom. It was much easier for me in a way. And going back to Britain, as I just described, you know, I always said, when asked the question, why did you leave Britain? I would say, well, I joined Reuters News Agency. I was assigned to Brussels. One thing led to another. That's how life is. So I left. No, I realized going back, I left because I wanted to leave. I needed to leave. It was the locus of the trauma. And it was also the locus of this slightly uneasy feeling that I've described. So yeah, I, you know, being an observer, being the other, really suited me for a very long time. And I was living in Paris, and I could imagine staying in Paris. And of course, a bit like Joyce Beckett, you know, went to Paris and for similar reasons. I'm not, of course, comparing myself to either of these great writers, but it suited me. And then suddenly I started asking myself these questions. I wanted to live with the English language around me. Mm. That became important to me, even though I'd lived in foreign languages for a long time and had learned to speak them. I wanted to return to an environment where I spoke my own language. And I, in the end, found a home in a city of others, which is New York. I think one of the distinctive features of New York is as soon as you arrive there, you're a New Yorker. So, but I had to feel I belonged somewhere.
I want to ask you about Israel, Roger, partly because it's in your book as an important place. It's in your columns as a place in crisis at a crossroads. You wrote an unforgettable column in December, quoting Amos Oz, to the effect that Israel is feeling a growing sense that it's an isolated ghetto and that it's heading toward either one state, which will eventually be majority Arab, or an Israeli dictatorship. Speak about it. And all the complexities of your growing up and your history and your identity coming to bear on your coverage of Israel.
The state of Israel, founded, of course, in 1948, it's an amazing success story in so many ways. It's a vibrant and now very prosperous democracy. But the state of Israel has been built on the statelessness of another people, the Palestinians. And I think for people like the Jews who wandered for so long, who were stateless for so long, and whose ethics say at a very fundamental level, treat the stranger as yourself, that which is painful unto you, do not do to your fellow man. Quite apart from the geostrategic considerations, this at a fundamental moral and ethical level. And the Jews are an ethical people. We came up with this idea of a formless, faceless God with whom we have this covenant of values that we bore with us around the world for millennia, written on parchment, engraved in stone. Mm. We were maintained by the word, and the word contained ethics. So for me personally, at least, and I am a Zionist because, as I described, I came to the conclusion, the reluctant conclusion, that Jews need a homeland. But the homeland I dream of is obviously one living in peace and security beside a Palestinian state, which, you know, I don't believe the land of Israel was deeded to the Jews in the Bible, as these messianic zealots in Israel, more and more of them, believe today. No, I believe the modern state of Israel is founded on international law in the form of the resolution of the United Nations in 1947 that, after the Holocaust, called for the establishment of two states, one Arab, one Jewish, on the territory of Mandate Palestine, that's to say the Holy Land. And for all the mental contortions that people have gone through over the last 6.5 decades. There is, infinitely distant as it may appear today, there is, in my view, no other conceivable outcome that will end the conflict. In the book, I look at a Zionist branch of my family, and they came from South Africa. And for anyone who's experienced apartheid, obviously seeing what has happened to the Palestinians is full of echoes. And my cousin in the family, the husband is a Likudnik. He believes that kind of get over it, we won, the land is ours. And his wife, she sees all these painful echoes, and she argues for the need for two states. Look, as long as the Palestinian issue is unresolved, this extraordinary House of Israel will remain on a shaky foundation. We all know that at some point, if we do not arrive at two states, there will be more Arabs than Jews on the territory of the Holy Land. What then is going to happen? The Zionists of 1948 believed in a Jewish and democratic state. How is Israel going to remain Jewish and democratic in those circumstances? That is why in the current election, the leader of the Labour Party, Isaac Herzog, and his ally, Tzipi Livni, who led the negotiations with the Palestinians, they are calling themselves what? They're calling themselves the Zionist camp. Because unlike Prime Minister Netanyahu, I believe they have, however difficult, far off, a genuine belief, not just a convenient belief embraced principally to kick the can down the road, which I think is the case of Prime Minister Netanyahu, a genuine belief that Israel needs to try to get out of a situation where it is exercising dominion and imposing humiliation on 2.5 million Palestinians in the West Bank. So that is why this is a very important election.
Come back to your own story, Roger Cohen, in the complexity, the twining of identities in your own head, and not to mention your professional standing too. Can you describe the pressures inside and out on an American Jew, a Jewish American, who writes as often as you do about Israel?
I've tried to carve out a clear position. I wrote a column last year called Zionism and Its Discontents. I described very briefly the story again of my uncle, of why I, after reflection, had become a Zionist, a strong supporter of Israel within its 1967 borders. And then described precisely my unease about the treatment of the Palestinians, this third Gaza war in 6 years, the killing of children. Hamas is vile. Its charter is vile. But this is a failure. This is a failure. It's a failure on both sides, but it's a failure on the part of Israel. And I don't believe that Israel has sought in good faith in recent years to reach a peace settlement. So that's the position I've tried to cover. And I've been much criticized by the uncritical school. I mean, AIPAC and others essentially take a position that to criticize Israel is to play into the hands of its enemies. We should not do that. I, like the newly emergent J Street organization, feel no. You show your commitment to and support of a friend, Israel, by when you notice egregious behavior of some kind. You say, hang on a second, don't we need to think again about this? What are the consequences of this? Where is this going? A 9-year-old child in Gaza has seen 3 wars. 9-year-old child, 3 wars. What kind of grown-up is that child going to turn into? Is this in Israel's interest? To have a place that is sealed off with 1.8 million human beings inside it. Is that a good thing? Is that a good thing for Israel? Can we think again about this? So I think there are a lot of Jews in America who've supported me also strongly in the positions I take. And one interesting thing is that if here I've been criticized more from the camp that says, don't criticize Israel, Iran is evil, period, and so on. In Europe, it's the fact that I'm a Zionist that tends to get picked up on more. It's criticism from the other side. Zionism is colonialism. Zionism is mistreating Palestinians. I said there are many echoes of apartheid. I lived apartheid. It's not apartheid. It you know, if you go on a road in the West Bank, which Palestinians are not allowed on, you cannot fail to see the echoes. But I think we have to be careful with language. Anyway, in Europe, support of Israel has become intellectually deeply unfashionable. And I think there's something is skewed there.
What are the consequences going to be? And when, do you suppose? And second, I keep wondering, how does this fit in the context of a world more and more alienated around Islam? Where are we going?
I don't know where we're going. I've seen so many surprises in my life, including good ones. You know, growing up in South Africa, the cataclysm was always coming, always coming. The swimming pools would be red with blood. My cousins kept warning me, you know, enjoy this. It's not going to last for long. And then Mandela and de Klerk. Mm. Or living in Germany and driving into Poland and not even knowing where the border was, in a place where a dozen million people were killed, dwarfing the casualties in the Middle East just 70 years ago. So we don't know. Things are full of surprises. Well, you know, Chris, at the end of the book, I quote some lines from the great Israeli poet Amichai, Yehuda Amichai. These are lines that really touch me a lot and I think are important. The poem's called Tourists, and he's in Jerusalem, and it goes more or less, you see that arch over there from the Roman period? It's not important. But just to the left and down a bit, there's a man, and he's just bought fruit and vegetables for his family. And that's so important, to get back to the prosaic, to get away from history, the wounds of history, the narratives of history. They don't really matter in the end. Jews and Palestinians are never going to agree on what happened in 1948. For the Jews, it was the foundation of the modern state of Israel. For Palestinians, it was the Nakba. It was the loss of hundreds and thousands of homes. There will never be convergence on this, but what matters is that there are fruit and vegetables, there be food on the tables of the children going forward. And we need to get away from the grandiloquence. We need to get away, oh, the Roman arch, so magnificent, built by so-and-so, land deeded in the Bible, this messianic sense of mission, and get back to jobs, food, a future, ordinary things. That's what I'd like to hear more talk of. And on that basis, I think we could move in a better direction.
It's a wonderful book, Roger Cohen. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you for the book. Thank you for the conversation. Roger Cohen's affecting memoir sweeps through more than a century from Lithuania to South Africa to London to the States. His title, in honor of his mother, is The Girl from Human Street, Ghosts of Memory from a Jewish Family. Mary McGrath recorded and edited our conversation. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project. Next stop, please, Kickstarter.com.